You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is November 16th, 2011, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Yuff up.
And Evan Bernstein.
Boas Noetis. To all of our listeners who speak the Galician language.
Or Galactican.
Yeah, that's what I thought it looked like too, Jay, but in looking at it a little closer, Galician is the language.
What is Galician?
It has its roots from a Latin-derived language based out of Western Spain and Portugal around the time of the 13th century. And there's currently 3.2 million native speakers in the world of that language.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the Yiddish of Spain, let's call it that.
What is this, Galician?
Exactly. You know, you learn something new every day.
That's what you learned today?
That's what I learned today. I didn't learn anything else except that.
Well, how about November 19th in history?
Yeah, so November 19th on this day in history, the Apollo 12 astronauts Pete Conrad and Alan Bean land at the Ocean of Storms on the moon and become the third and fourth humans to walk on the moon.
Oceanus Procellarum.
Awesome.
That is it.
Sounds cooler in Latin.
It does. I don't know. Ocean of Storms, that's pretty cool too.
Ocean of Storms is pretty cool.
Isn't that the next book in the Game of Thrones series?
Oh my God, I was thinking the same thing.
Isn't that also a region on the moon?
Yeah.
Good one, Jay.
Yeah. Love it.
That's where they landed.
Apollo 12 is one of the missions that really gets forgotten about. You know, you have obviously Apollo 11, which is the seminal moment.
Yeah. And 12 was the one after that, right?
12, yes. And the one after that is Apollo 13. Of course, you know, the botched mission, with the failure and everything, and the very popular, excellent movie that it was based on. But 12 kind of gets lost in the mix.
It's
in
the
a sense.
Forgotten, you know, Apollo mission.
Aww.
It is.
You know why? Because it was successful. It was the second. So, you know, it wasn't the first, and nothing bad happened. They went to the moon. They completed their mission. They came back.
Well, actually, something bad sort of did happen. They almost had to abort the mission.
Yeah, but almost doesn't count.
Horseshoes and hand grenades.
But 36 and a half, this is cool.
And tiddlywinks.
They're in liftoff, 36 seconds into the mission, and lightning becomes discharged through the ship, down through the Saturn V rocket, right down to the Earth. It was through the ionized plume. And the protective circuits on the fuel cells in the service module falsely detected overloads and took all the fuel cells offline. They didn't know what to do. They almost had to abort the mission until Bean remembered seeing this in a simulation about a year ago that they were practicing for. And they switched something over to auxiliary power, and that corrected the problem. But it was really a guess. They weren't sure that was going to work. But turns out it did, and off to the moon they went.
Awesome.
On a less than memorable mission, right?
That's good work, boys.
And something else, one other little interesting factoid, they used Doppler radar in order to land pretty much precisely on target where they wanted to, and that was the first time that had been used by NASA.
Yeah, well, Apollo 11 landed way off. So, they were testing this new method for precise landing, and it worked well.
Yep, it did.
Yep.
So the moon is cool.
The moon is cool, and that's why that's our next news item too, Bob. You're going to tell us about the moon's magnetic field.
Yeah, this is pretty interesting. A 40-year-old moon mystery may have been solved recently. It looks like that we may have two viable theories, not one. We've got two viable theories why some moon rocks that were brought back in the 70s and were examined are magnetized, even though there's no magnetic field around the moon now, and we don't know how there ever could have been until recently, of course. So it pretty much started in the 70s that moon rocks that were brought back from the Apollo missions that caused quite a surprise when they examined them and they discovered that they were magnetized. And this, of course, meant that there almost certainly had to be some sort of magnetosphere around the moon at some point in its past. I'm not sure why the article I read said almost certainly. I mean, it seems 100% certain to me. I mean, if they're magnetized.
Well, it's possible that Magneto went back in time to the moon and magnetized the rocks where he landed.
I knew it. I just knew it.
So that's, you know, you got to hold out for that, you know.
Okay. There's the 0.0000. 0.001%. The problem, though, is how did the moon actually make a magnetic field? That's what the big mystery has been for over 40 years. The moon is too small to make them, though, in at least in the way that the Earth does. So the Earth's magnetic field is caused by the interplay of two things. You got the convection of electric charges, which is really key. That's primary. But you also got rotation, which is also pretty important. So this is the essence of a geodynamo. And this is exactly what stars do as well. This is how how stars create their magnetic fields. The large temperature differences of the liquid metallic alloys in the outer core of the Earth causes like this lava lamp type convection of these electrically conducting fluids. So these fluids move up and down through convection. And this, coupled with the rotation of the core, is what really creates this magnetic field that extends all the way to the surface and far into space, and which, of course, totally saves our ass from the solar wind. So it's really nice to have a magnetosphere.
And Jupiter has a very strong magnetosphere, and that's because of the metallic hydrogen, right?
There you go, the moving charges, yep.
Do you guys think, with all these fortunate things that made it so life could exist on the Earth?
Don't go there.
Wait. Do you think, though, that if, say, the moon didn't have a property that protects life, that other life would have evolved?
Well, sure. Life that would have been able to evolve in the different environment that whatever the moon lacked caused.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, life adapted to the environment, and so the environment is perfect for whatever life exists because, life evolved and adapted to it. But the question is, how far can you stretch that before you're outside the parameters that organic life can form and be stable? And it's hard to say.
Like a very wise Ian Malcolm once said, life finds a way.
Jurassic Park.
So it's possible if the terrain on the Earth and the environment on the Earth was like totally badass, that some form of life could have evolved that could just withstand extreme temperatures.
Jay, like the Horta?
Jay, look at – dude, no. Not that extreme, but Jay, look at extremophiles. There's bacteria that could survive boiling water. They could survive radiation in space. I mean, sure, it might be so nasty on Earth that all you'd ever really have is these extremophile bacteria. But so
yeah,
sure,
but Bob, they wouldn't be extremophiles. They would be normophiles. That would be normal for them. We would be the extremophiles.
Well, the cool part about thinking about this, Bob, isn't that it would be some bacteria. It'd have to be a complex organism that can think and all. I'm just thinking of like the wicked tough alien that can withstand pretty much anything.
Yeah, they would be sitting around wondering if the Earth had a magnetic field, you think life could have evolved and survived in a constant magnetic field? Oh my goodness! All right, so Bob, so what's the mechanism? Let me get this back on track. What's the mechanism for the moon having a magnetic field?
Well, the point is that the moon can't have a magnetic field the way that the Earth does or stars do. It's way too small. The temperature differences that are near the core just aren't great enough to support any type of convection that would be required. How did the moon then magnetize these rocks? So clearly, there's got to be another way for a geomagnetic field to be created, and this is exactly what these two new theories are dealing with in the Journal of Nature. I think they're in there now. The first theory describes the moon after it was formed. I think we've talked about this before. In those early years, it was much closer to the Earth. I think it appeared 15 times bigger in the sky. It was much closer.
Wow, that's cool.
Imagine that night view. So the tidal forces were equally great. They were really titanic. The moon raised mountain-sized tides on the Earth. But that also means that the Earth probably had a pretty dramatic tidal impact on the moon as well.
You know what just occurred to me, Bob, when you say that? And I know we've talked about this before, but in a lot of science fiction shows, they show these massive moons in the sky, of the planet because it's beautiful. But there would have to be a titanic tidal force as well.
Oh, my God, yeah.
And they never really show that. So they have sort of planets that are like Earth, but they have these gigantic moons in the sky without accounting for the fact that there would have to be an equally gigantic tidal force.
Would multiple moons – how would multiple – could one on each side of the planet sort of equal it out?
No, that would make it worse. If they were on exact opposite sides of the world, the tidal forces would actually reinforce each other.
All right. Well, is there a configuration, if you had multiple moons, that it could sort of balance each other out, the things that remain stable enough for life to evolve?
I don't think it would balance out that way. I think you'd end up having – you could end up having four tides a day type of thing.
Yeah.
Or just – yeah, or really big ones or – yeah, it would not be nice.
All right.
So Earth's tidal force caused the moon's mantle to actually rotate around a different axis than the molten core was rotating. And this causes turbulence within the molten iron that gives rise to magnetic fields, which in turn imprinted itself onto the rocks cooling on the surface of the moon, which are the ones we found. Now, this second theory describes a moon that's being pelted by waves and waves of asteroids. And this gargantuan energy that these asteroids impart on the moon caused the mantle to actually rotate against the rotation of the core, causing turbulence again, which gives rise to the magnetic field. And this turbulence could last for 10,000 years, which would be plenty of time for cooling rock to fossilize the magnetic orientation. So in fact, the period of time in the solar system when this was a common occurrence, it's called the late heavy bombardment, is precisely when the moon's magnetic field seems to have existed. So you've got these two really interesting theories, and they are very complementary because they both share that this key point that convection is not absolutely required. Simple mechanical stirring is really all you need, it seems, if these theories pan out, to create a magnetic field around a celestial object.
Yeah, it's neat. So it's essentially the key component was that the core is rotating at a different angle than the outer mantle, so they're sort of rubbing up against each other, causing
the turbulence, which causes the movement of the electrical charges. And the rotation too, which helps create the magnetic field. And there you go.
Well, we actually got one more astronomy news item this week, but we'll do this one quickly. This one is about Europa, one of the coolest moons in the solar system because it potentially has an ocean of liquid water underneath its icy outer shell. And it is it's on the short list of worlds in our solar system that might have life. You know, liquid water.
It's number one on that list.
Yeah, it could be very well be number one. But one of the questions is how thick is the ice on the surface? And this is a hotly debated topic among the relevant astronomers. And it makes a difference because, you know, if it's really thick being greater than 10 kilometers, let's say, it would be a lot harder for us to send a probe there and drill down through the ice to get to the liquidy center. But if it's thin, like at 3 kilometers, then it would be a lot more plausible to be able to do that.
Wasn't there another important point, though, that they said something about the interaction of the surface with the liquid underneath would help give a boost to the potential of life? And I didn't really understand why that interaction would be helpful, but they did kind of key in on that.
Why don't we just nuke a hole in the surface and just then send a probe after that?
Yeah, just blow it apart. Yeah.
Hello, aliens.
The Bruce Willis effect.
We come in peace.
Yeah, we come Boom. In peace. So you're talking about a new study also published in Nature, a lot of interesting articles in the recent Nature, where the astronomers were looking at the formation of the ice sheet on the surface, that basically features on the surface of Europa and how to account for them. It's pretty technical. I confess I don't fully understand what they're talking about. But essentially they're looking at these zones called chaos terrain and how they form. They came up with a model of how they could form that implies a thin ice sheet on at least at that section over the chaos terrain of about 3 kilometers. So that would mean that at least in those locations, there's a very thin, you know, again, the 3 kilometer ice sheet on the surface of Europa. Then what you're talking about, Bob, is that also this would imply a convection of the hotter, you know, warmer water from deeper down to the surface. And that why that's significant for the question of life is because that would mix nutrients into the ocean and make it, you know, life more viable because it'd be
so there's nutrients on the surface.
No, just in the water, in mixing in the ocean of Europa, the under the ice ocean, basically dragging up minerals from deeper in Europa up into the water, up into the ocean. So that would be a resource for any Europeans.
Europeans,
yeah. And one of the articles I read on BBC was saying that the U.S. and Europe are working on missions to Europa that they're planning hopefully either later in this decade or early in the 2020s. But I hadn't heard anything really specific about that.
You know, it's times like this that I wish Superman was real. You know, like, hey, Soup, you know, fly to Europa, come back with a sample. You know, you'll be back in a day. You'll save us a quadrillion dollars. Come on.
Yeah. Bob, Really? Like, that's all we would use Superman for? Like,
no, yes. That's not all. That would be a key activity.
But that's the thing, Bob, that you would be like...
If Superman exists, we already know there's intelligent life in the universe. It's Superman. He's an alien.
Oh, you're getting silly now.
That's not silly.
Because what you said isn't ridiculous or silly at all.
Yeah, I think you started it.
It's not ridiculous. Superman would be a boon to science.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, do you think that he would be like science's bitch, just waiting around for them to say, go here, go there?
No, he wouldn't be our bitch, but, a couple days a year he could devote to science.
More than that. I think that would be a high priority.
Oh, yeah, we'd find a way to knock him out and cut him open. In days, probably.
Figure what makes him tick.
Yeah.
Hey, look at that.
Right. You would just, just use some kryptonite. That's
all. The U.S. government would stockpile kryptonite and build a kryptonite jail and then experiment on him for the rest of his days.
Yeah. I'm really glad we didn't get off topic on this one.
What were you talking about? Europa.
Yeah, Europa, it's cool. All right. Let's change topics completely. Rebecca, you're going to tell us about false confessions and why that they are can be even more misleading than you might think.
Yeah, we are. I mean, you can already guess that false confessions would be a terrible thing. They are a terrible thing, and they happen at a frequency that's probably higher than most people suspect. So they're bad enough when you have people who are making false confessions under duress, or maybe they have a low IQ, or for some other reason. But a recent study shows that they can actually be even worse than just – it's not just the person falsely confessing to a crime. That false confession actually sort of reverberates throughout the criminal justice process and can end up influencing other people in the other people who are investigating the crime. So basically what the study did was look at 241 people who had been exonerated by the Innocence Project since 1992. And a quarter of those involved false confessions, and 75% involved eyewitness mistakes. And what the researchers found was that the cases that involved false confessions had a much larger instance of multiple errors turning up on the part of the people investigating the crime. What they found was that false confessions can influence, for instance, people who are in the lab, who are testing the DNA results, people who are polygraph examiners. That's of course a whole other topic for another day.
Yeah.
But fingerprint experts and other people, when these people are told that there's a false confession involved in the case, they are much more likely to make a mistake, according to this study.
So why? Because it influences them to dislike the person on trial or to like the person on trial?
No, when they're told there's a confession, to be clarified, when they're told there's a confession, they don't know it's false.
Sorry.
Yeah, they don't know. Yeah. So they're saying, oh, this guy confessed. Therefore,
and it's wrong.
Oh, yeah. He confessed, therefore he must be guilty. And then just like Sherlock Holmes said, once you have the theory, you then twist the facts in order to fit the theory, right? It's amazing how every little piece of evidence can be twisted in that. They also mentioned this is confirmation bias that we always talk about. I mean, they just the researchers going over the kinds of things that they discovered, where, for example, eyewitnesses may not come forward because they think, oh, well, I must be wrong because this guy confessed, so I'm not going to give my testimony that would exonerate him. Eyewitnesses that contradict the confession are dismissed. But then even they give examples of, as Rebecca was saying, of DNA experts giving wrong testimony, such as the one
so
example
the DNA
they give,
could disintegrate and change.
Yeah.
Like what?
Yeah, I mean, basically making false excuses for why the evidence doesn't corroborate the confession.
Oh wow!
And this is exactly why in science we have double-blinded experiments, because the science isn't this cut and dried thing that is automatically going to speak for itself. There are a million little ways that humans can influence the process, and this is a real life way that it's a real life example of what kind of a serious impact this can have on people's lives. Because, you know, this can actually put people away. You know, a false confession featured prominently in the famous West Memphis 3 case, which I think we've talked about before on the show, where three teenagers in Arkansas were jailed due to satanic murders of some yeah. children in their area. When in fact there was no real evidence to convict them. One of the kids had a very low IQ. He was kept in custody for a long time. He eventually gave a confession, and that's recently been, they were very recently exonerated. There's a huge number of people out there who are being falsely imprisoned due to things like this. So yeah. it's a really interesting study that shows why we need double blinding in circumstances like this.
Or even just single blinding. I mean, just whoever's making the judgment can't know what the outcome is supposed to be. Otherwise, it's not independent. That's what they were saying, that you know, one of the checks and balances, you know, for guaranteeing that you don't falsely convict the innocent is that there has to be corroborating evidence, which is a good principle. But if that corroborating evidence is all contaminated by people knowing what the outcome is supposed to be ahead of time, then it's not independent. It's all, as you say, it all flows from the one false assumption. It's just amazing how easily we can do that to ourselves. And in processes even outside of science, any investigative process, you know, without that blinding, we'll just lead ourselves astray. We see the exact same thing in medicine. Your physicians make bad diagnoses and then stick with them and then start to – I've seen this happen every day. You know, people – how easy it is to dismiss inconvenient evidence that doesn't fit your diagnosis or what you think is going on, rather than just always stepping back and saying, all right, could this be interpreted a different way? Could I be wrong? What are the alternatives? What do we really know for sure? You know what I mean? If you don't systematically do that, you can convince yourself of anything. It's good to be reminded of that. It's one of the core skeptical principles we can't forget. So, Evan, it's time for Who's That Noisy?
It is, isn't it? So, let's play last week's Who's That Noisy and do a little review. Here we go.
Flying saucers, and they've had other things, you know.
Who was that and what was he saying?
That is former President Harry S. Truman. Yes, he was commenting on flying saucers, UFOs. This was back in a clip taken from 1952 in which the famous UFOs over Washington, D.C. video was captured, kind of took the nation by surprise, if nothing else, and has become, I don't know, iconic in its own right.
Yeah, you see that commonly referenced still in UFO proponents' best cases.
But, you know, it's interesting because starting with Harry Truman, he sort of became, I don't know, like the first UFO president in a sense. Mm-hmm. And in another sense, every president since has been asked, or every administration, I should say, has been hounded by UFO enthusiasts, asking them to tell the public what they know about, you know, little green men and alien bodies, flying saucers and whatever else.
Yeah. Well, at the time, you know, it really was a new phenomenon, the whole UFO thing. And there were legitimate security issues, such as enemy nations using UFO reports as a distraction or as a psychological campaign, maybe even to provide cover for legitimate intrusions into our airspace. So that they were thinking about it in those terms, you know, the government, meaning not necessarily, even if they didn't think that there was, you know, flying saucers or alien spacecraft, they were still concerned about it as a potential threat to our security.
Yeah, so they had to take things like that as if, well, maybe people think they're seeing something, but it actually could be, you know, a Russian spy plane or something.
Yeah, right. All right, Evan, and who guessed that correctly?
Well, our dear friend and devoted listener, Trinok, once again. So congratulations to Trinok
He's getting too good at these.
Yeah. Is there something we can do about that?
Steve, Rebecca and I came up with a good idea. Let's have Trinok do his own Who's That Noisy.
If he wants to, sure. And that way he can't guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's one way.
That's the only way we came up with to take him out of the game in a fair manner.
Okay.
At least for 1 week.
Yeah, for 1 week.
Right. So we'll see if he accepts our challenge. Meanwhile, Evan, what do you got for this week?
Okay, brand new, fresh, hot off the presses, this week's Who's That Noisy?
He's here every day. Is that good or bad for your business with him hanging around?
Don't think it makes any difference. Kind of like my chiropractor.
All right. Interesting.
Go ahead, post your answer on our forums, on our message boards, or send us an email at info@theskepticsguide.org. And of course, good luck to everyone.
Thanks, Evan. All right, we're going to move on to a listener email. This one is a correction from last week. Are you guys familiar with Poe's Law?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I am now.
Poe's Law is as follows. This was formulated by Nathan Poe only in August 2005, not just to be taken for granted now, but it really was very recently, and who wrote, without a winking smiley or other blatant display of humor, it is utterly impossible to parody a creationist in such a way that someone won't mistake it for the genuine article.
And this has been adapted to people saying that something is a Poe.
Yeah.
If it rides that line between parody and real.
Right. And it's been also extended beyond creationists to fundamentalists or even really any pseudoscience that's sufficiently crazy. It's hard to – it's like beyond parody. And when you attempt to parody it, people will think that you are serious. So with that in mind, getting back to our discussion of the BMJ article last week about the research of intercessory prayer – retroactively, praying for people who were sick 4 or 5 years previously, we got a letter from Jack Gibson from Nottingham. And he writes, guys, felt the need to send a quick mail after hearing you trash one of my employers on the latest podcast. I'm one of the stats editors for BMJ Group. The BMJ has a long tradition of running seriously conducted research articles on absurd topics in the Christmas edition each year. The paper on intercessory prayer is one of them. Note the publication date of 22 December 2001. It's not meant to be taken seriously. Then he gives us an example of other articles in that issue or similar issues. Longevity of screenwriters who win an Academy Award, longitudinal study. The case of the disappearing teaspoons, longitudinal cohort study of the displacement of teaspoons in an Australian research institute. And here's one. How long did their hearts go on, a Titanic study?
Oh, God.
Ice cream evoked headaches study, randomized trial of accelerated versus cautious ice cream eating regimen. So apparently it is true that what he's saying is correct. And this is the Christmas issue of BMJ where they run. They're not really parodies. You have to actually do the research, apparently. But the researchers are in on the joke. It's not like serious researchers who are getting an Ig Nobel. You know what I mean? They're doing a sort of a joke study, and the BMJ is publishing it, which I was not aware of that they did this. And I don't know why I don't know how long this tradition's been going on, and why they don't do it in the April 1st issue.
Because it's too obvious. Then I really appreciate that because I hate April Fool's pranks because they're so obvious. So I think it's nice to do it at Christmas time.
Well, so here's the thing is that it's apparently very obvious from the print version of the journal that it's all a parody, that it's all in fun. But now these articles are online as a peer review published article, and you find them and there's absolutely no indication, unless you check the date and know this tradition, there's no indication that this isn't a serious article published by a real peer-reviewed journal, right? Which is what happened to us.
Yeah, they should probably put a little note there.
Yeah, they should make the online versions as obvious as the printed version that, hey, this is, you know, some kind of indicator that this is, you know, in fun for the Christmas issue. The other thing is that the article was not really any different than other intercessory prayer studies. We talked about one, remember, about a year ago that was just as absurd as this.
That's
one.
That's what made it so, yeah, I mean, it's, right. Why would you think it was a parody?
It absolutely is Poe's Law. I mean, the thing is, the whole notion of intercessory prayer is just as magical as doing it back in time, which is actually makes us a really great parody. You know, it is, now that I know it's not serious, it's really funny. But there really wasn't any way, in my opinion, to know that it wasn't serious because it was just like any other intercessory prayer study.
Steve, I'd argue that even making it obvious online would be, it would obviously be better, but I still think that's not a great idea because you could still say, well, look at this study I did, or look at this study this person did, and it was in this peer-reviewed journal. Just saying it, or even cutting and pasting the article out of the website, I think could, it still could be very misleading, and I don't know if it's worth it.
It's, I mean, I know, I mean, I started doing that for my own, occasionally I'll write like a satirical piece, and I have to put a disclaimer in there because the first time I did it, I wrote a satirical piece about alternative engineering.
I like that.
And basically,
article.
Yeah, applying all of the same kind of rationalizations that people use to defend alternative medicine and applying it to like building bridges and cars. To me, it was blatantly obvious satire. And yet, I was contacted by a senior producer at 2020 who thought it was dead serious and wanted to interview me about alternative engineering, and I had to let them down and tell them it was satire.
Oh, okay. I did not know that. That's
right?
Amazing that you get instant attention when you say absurd things.
Yeah, right. Exactly. That's the other thing. Yeah, I made a completely absurd claim, even though you know I thought it was obvious it wasn't serious. And like, I got immediately, I'm you know talking to a senior producer at 2020.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I wonder, I haven't had time to like really search, because you'd have to actually dig up the full articles and read the methods and everything. But I wonder if anyone's done a review of intercessory prayer and included this article in the review.
Oh, interesting.
You know. Anyway, let's move on. We got one more email. This one comes from Cindy Lebsack from the United States. And she writes, "Hi, guys. I listened with interest to the pox party bit because our neighbors do this. They intentionally expose their youngest children to chickenpox if someone in the community has it. I was surprised that you didn't mention that their particular rationale for doing this with this particular disease. They are Catholic and will not use the chickenpox vaccine because it was developed using aborted human embryo tissue. My BS alarm started flashing when they told me this, but surprisingly, as far as I can Google, this seems to be real. It puts a much more interesting spin on the bioethics of their situation because rather than being demonstrably factually wrong like the typical anti-vaxxers, they are ethically opposed to using a medicine. I would love to hear your take on this. My thought is that by not vaccinating, they are putting many more babies, embryos, elderly, and otherwise immunodeficient people in danger. My other question would be, is there an ethical and safer way to do this? What quarantine procedures would they need to employ? Can other family members leave the house while there is a sick child sick with chickenpox without exposing the community? There is a large population of Catholics in my area doing this, and the issue comes around almost every year. Fighting back against it requires knowing where the other side is coming from." Then she also gave me a link, which I had seen previously, actually, to the Vatican's response to this issue. But first, let me just give the quick backstory. So it is true that some vaccines were developed using cell lines that themselves were developed from aborted fetal tissue. So
legally aborted fetal tissue from like the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
Not
well, yeah, but the Catholics don't care legal or, you know.
Yeah, but I think it's – I just think it's important to distinguish because I feel like there are some people out there who are spreading the idea that there are aborted fetuses in vaccines.
Well, yeah, you're right. You're right, Rebecca. Some anti-vaxxers will claim that vaccines contain aborted fetal tissue, and that is incorrect. Right. They were simply reproduced in cell lines that were previously – that were derived, you know, again, 40 years ago from an aborted tissue. So, but there is no, there are no fetuses in vaccines. That's a lie that some anti-vaxxers tell today. But in this case, they get their facts straight. It's just that they don't want to, I guess, eat the fruit from the poison tree, right? They don't want to use a medicine that was derived unethically in their opinion. And again, just putting the ethics of that, of abortion, et cetera, aside, we just take it, that's their belief. So given that premise, that, you know, again, they do not accept abortion, what kind of ethical situation does that put them in?
And yet, ethical. I bet if they were on, let's say, an organ donation list and a full-grown man was murdered and his organs were harvested and offered to them, I guarantee that they would accept those organs without hesitation, despite the fact that they disagree with the way in which that man's life was dispatched.
Yeah, so these are interesting ethical questions, and you're creating a dilemma where there's no one clear right or wrong answer. So I read through the Vatican response. Actually, I read through the summary of their full decision. And the summary is so unbelievably long-winded. It's funny. I mean, they go on and on and on.
They got paid by the letter.
And it's so funny. They go through all of like the authority. It's like it's one massive argument from authority. It's very interesting. But in the end, they make a very cogent argument, which I think is reasonable. And they essentially say that, yes, there are moral problems with the vaccine, but there's also moral problems with not getting vaccinated.
Yes, exactly.
And if you balance the two things, there's this tenuous connection to an abortion that happened 40 years ago versus putting people, your children and your community, at immediate risk by not getting vaccinated, that the lesser of two evils essentially is to get vaccinated. So get
exactly.
vaccinated. So that they, I agree with the decision they make at the end, and they do, you know, make a, I think, a legitimate ethical argument. So I guess, you know, to Cindy and to others and to, you know, to any Catholics who happen to be listening or any conscientious objector, because it's interesting to point out that the Vatican had, you know, looked at this issue and they came to the decision that it's ethical to get vaccinated. They do say that you should, you know, if there is an alternate vaccine, you should use the alternate vaccine that isn't derived from cell lines that were derived from aborted tissue. And you should advocate for the replacement or the development of new vaccines that do not ultimately lead, you know, lead back to that. But in the absence of that, get vaccinated. That's what they say.
Reasonable.
Mm-hmm. And in the absence of that, move to Antarctica.
We are joined now by Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson. Welcome back to The Skeptic's Guide. It's so much of a
pleasure. Thank you. Thank you. It's been a while.
It's been a while.
Yeah. Years.
Mm-hmm. We catch up with you when you're at TAM.
Yeah.
So tell us about what you're going to be talking about.
I thought long and hard about this because I don't know what new I could share with an audience that prides itself on the depth of skepticism that they bring to others. Mm-hmm. And when you gather a room full of such people, what do you tell them? You know, don't trust what you hear. You know, what edict is left that I could possibly share? And so what I thought I would do is, talk is titled Adventures in Science Illiteracy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be drawing from my life experience encounters with profoundly scientifically illiterate people, institutions, organizations, and politicians.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really a kind of a session of commiseration.
Wow.
And so maybe at the end I'll be begging for sympathy for and shared concern for what I encounter, because I have very many sort of public or extensive enough public exposures so that I see things that might not show up in everybody else's life. And so that's what I want to share, the nooks and crannies of where this can go awry.
Well, I think you very much know your audience, because the last time you were at TAM, from what I could tell, the best audience reactions, I think because you are known for your affability, I think that the audience really enjoyed it whenever you would just take a shot at someone.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, yeah, actually, yeah, I mean, there aren't many audiences where that would work or even matter. And so here, it's I actually feel a deep kinship. Spiritual kinship with this audience. And so it actually gives me certain speaking freedoms that I wouldn't otherwise have.
Yeah.
Well, I for one really value your ability to target to your audience. Not, you know, it's fun here at these meetings, but more so your ability to present the message that I think we all want to get out there to an audience that is not always receptive to our message.
Well, thanks for noticing that, because I do invest a lot of sort of emotional and intellectual energy to try to accomplish that. And I guess the greatest compliment I can get is when someone says, "Oh, you're so natural." It's like, you have no idea what went behind that. And the people who do notice are educators.
Mm-hmm.
They'll come up, while others are saying, "You're such a natural," they're saying, "You were working hard up there."
Yeah.
And because they recognize and understand and value that extra effort to link to what might be the tangled mental roadways of an audience.
Yeah.
And so, yes, I do put effort in that. I'm glad somebody notices. Thank you.
It's a skill set that most scientists don't have.
Well, I think it's many people think that to be an educator is you have a lesson plan and you deliver it. Mm-hmm. And whether they receive it or not, if they don't, then it becomes their problem. Mm-hmm. Oh, they don't want to learn, or they can't learn, or they have a learning disability. And I think the education at its best is an investment in knowing what channels either are already open that you didn't notice before, or what channels can you create from your message into the brain wiring of the listener.
Mm-hmm. How did you develop that skill set? And I ask that with the hopes that we can somehow encourage other scientifically literate people to adopt those skills.
I think one of the – I don't know if this critique applies only to scientists or to anyone in general who might want to communicate. So let me just state it. I think anyone who's educated can put together a sentence, can write, you know, they can write, they can speak. And so often what comes along with that ability is the expectation that you can communicate. Mm-hmm. And just because you can write a sentence doesn't mean you can communicate a sentence. And these are two different exercises. One of them, for example, is what you might do to write an encyclopedia article. You're an expert in something, you put it down to page. And anyone can read it, but you don't expect encyclopedia articles to be riveting or page-turning experiences. The page-turning experience is a whole other investment, not only in your writing skill, but in your speaking skill, if it's speaking is what it is you intend to do. And so all I did was I said, well, how can I be better at this? I never asserted that what I was doing was good enough. Or even good. I just always felt, okay, so how would I know better? Next time, let me monitor the eyebrows and the dilation of the pupils or the facial expressions. There's a lot of body language reading that goes on. Because as I speak, I'll know what words I use that trigger interest, what phrasing works best, what pauses to take between ideas to allow a person to digest a thought and be ready for the next one. So the dynamics here, I think, is a little bit trial and error, but it's not hard because the feedback is instant. It's there if you're paying attention.
Yeah.
But if you're not paying attention, then the person is just a pair of ears there, and you don't know to recognize it and to embrace it. What I used to like to do, I don't do this much anymore, but I used to get a movie that had very good actors in it. And just turn down the sound and imagine what it is they were thinking and saying just by their acting. Mm-hmm. And good actors, their whole body expresses what it is they're saying and thinking. And that would work my experience in reading body language. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then you fold that into what it is you've been saying or what you plan to say. So I have an entire edited portfolio of things I talk about with regard to the universe. There are things that interest me, but I know would bore people to tears. I don't even go there. And there's the rest that excite me and excite the audience, or there's some that don't excite me but I know excite the audience. And so I pick and choose depending on the messages I need to deliver.
Well, it's encouraging to hear you say that because, you know, anybody that's producing any kind of content, you know, we want to get better at what we do and we want to be more entertaining and not lose our edge or not lose our ability to deliver the content.
You don't want to lose anything.
Right.
Do it all but not lose anything.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So that's good. But, you know, we also have to – you're very charismatic. And that's part of it. But I love the idea that it's calculated behind the scenes. Because, you know, anyone can make themselves more educated and even, dare say, even smarter, right? We can make our brains work a little bit better by practicing at it and everything. But you definitely achieve something that 99.999% of the population can't do. First, you're accomplished at your education. You're very accomplished. And you're a leader. You're a thought leader in what you do. Oh, Christ.
Oh.
No, we don't have time for this. No.
Are they calling you Christ now?
Podcast bombing. Hi, Neil.
All right, come on.
We've got a headset.
Just sit down.
Hair Dr. Phil Plate. There's an extra headset there.
Yeah, a chance should have
who
it.
Who told him we were in here?
It has Phil's name
on
the side.
No one needs to
side.
Tell him. Wait, but that's one of his senses is publicity.
We should tell Neil that this is a long-standing tradition. I think it started with Adam Savage.
It's true. Yes. Adam Savage
Dwight,
bombed you.
Jumped in on my podcast with these suckers here.
Oh,
and
okay.
And NGO, and I think Richard Wiseman has, and it's a long tradition.
Podcast crashing.
Yes. Yeah. Let me finish my thought real quick. But you did the thing.
You act like I interrupted you.
Come on, Neil.
You know what, Neil? Just shut up.
Let you finish your thought.
I'm talking
I'm just
over here.
Sitting
right?
here.
So as developers of content, we want to get the message out. We want to reach a wider audience. And you went through the thing. You are a rock star. Now, I'm the lowly musician that just bought a guitar, and I want to know how to become a rock star. Is it really a huge portion luck? Is there a secret that you stumbled on? Is there an avenue that we could practice?
It's an excellent question. I think it's a little bit of all of the above. And I think I started out as generally a socialized person. Not remarkably socialized among socialized people, but socialized among those who you wouldn't think would be socialized. So generally the scientific community is stereotyped as not being sort of social animals, the last one out at the party kind of thing. So in that group, I had more sort of social adroitness than others.
Why are you looking at full plate when you say that?
No.
Hey, Clavin.
But I think it was nonetheless average if I were in a group of people where their livelihood thrives on their ability to communicate.
Right.
So that alone, I don't think was is what made a difference. But it put me in a place to notice how people are paying attention and when and where and why they're paying attention and when they're not. Mm-hmm. So and there are other little things. For example, my appearances on talk shows. Some people are like, they go on, fellow scientists, for example, and the talk show hosts, particularly the comedic ones, Jon Stewart, they're like dancing circles around them, and there's a frustration there because you're not getting your point across. Well, excuse me, if you devoted your life to understanding the universe and you wrote a PhD thesis that's hundreds of pages long and you know how to, if this is what you're capable of, then why don't you study the show before you get on? That's what I did. I said, what is the rhythm of how long it takes Jon Stewart before he interrupts you after a question? There's a rhythm to that, okay?
Oh, yeah.
Is it 3 seconds? Is it 4 seconds? So then I would parcel the information I'd be delivering to fit those two, three, four-second intervals. And in that way, I could get my point across. He can crack the joke, and then the joke can be on a formed thought rather than a fragmented thought,
right,
which then has the interview self-disassemble in situ.
Yeah.
But one of my most memorable moments of you on television is during the Einstein show that they did for Science Channel, and they're getting your opinion about the first photographs that came back, in which they're trying to analyze the stars in the background, and you just gesture like this, and it came back, and it was a smudge, and that's all you said, and you kind of moved your fingers a little bit and just made this expression, and I was dying.
I'm glad you noticed that, because I've occasionally accused of being Italian with
that's a compliment, but go on.
Okay.
We're all Italian here, except for the grazie type.
Grazie.
Forget about it.
Because the stereotyped Italian uses hand gestures frequently. But I studied that, and I found there is a difference. The Italian uses the hand, those who do, use their hands as punctuation in a sentence. So their hands sort of move, and they're adding sort of emphasis.
Exactly.
Okay? When I use my hands, that's not how I use them. And my hands are part of my body, my hips, my neck, my eyebrows, and my body is drawing a picture, when it can, of the content that I'm delivering. And I learned to do this back in the days when I was a TA, as a graduate student, because what I found is that students learn more deeply the more senses you can excite in the effort of teaching them. And so it's one thing to speak to them, and then they hear you. And it's one thing for them to see you speak. Okay, but what does that do unless the act of seeing you speak contains extra graphical information for them to embrace? Yeah. And so when I think of – I remembered imitating the display of one of our – asteroids, our meteorites at the Museum of Natural History, the Willamette meteorite. In the old Hayden, because we rebuilt it 10 years ago, it was sort of plunked down on a pier. And it was like, look how big our meteorite is. We remounted it to be more precariously placed, visually precariously placed. And then we surrounded it with an exhibit on asteroid impacts. Rather than look at our artifact, look at what is it made of, how big is it. We created a storyline out of it. But I gave several talks where when I described the mounting of the asteroid, I'll do this, even though we're audio here, I'll do it in front of you. I gestured like this. I said, the meteorite was just sort of plunked down in this pier.
And it's
just
currently plunking.
Plunked down. And that created a visual reference for people that added to the word, if my word didn't otherwise hit the home run for them.
Definitely. It, no doubt about it. It makes it so you have to say less. Right?
Yeah. And I think I think we should use all available ways to inform the senses that people have brought to the room.
So you're saying
listen.
Go Italian.
Go teach your Italian. He's saying go better than Italian.
Go better than Italian.
But I mean, the research backs that up, too. I mean, what you learned is backed up by a lot of research, which shows, there's ways to affect the retention and people's attention. First of all, people could pay attention for about 20 minutes. That's it. Unless you completely re-engage them in some way. Mm-hmm.
That's why our podcast is an hour and 20 minutes.
Right. Except when I'm on, then it's like 4 hours.
And every sensory modality you add adds to people's perception and retention of the information you're trying to get across. So it's
sensory modality. Did those words actually come
he
out of your mouth?
Said that.
Yeah, he actually said that.
Okay. Yeah, you and the guy that came up with that term know what it means. Okay,
I had to look that up listening to this because he's a doctor, so he talks about that's not a very effective modality of medicine.
Right. The modality.
Yeah. So
Let's
is that not a word you guys use in your everyday vernacular?
Never.
No.
Is vernacular a word you use in your everyday?
Modal's a math word, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a programming word and a math word.
Okay.
But the real question is, have you ever heard anyone else use that word?
Yeah, all my colleagues.
Your colleagues. Just the people you're trying to train.
Right.
That's right. I train people.
I heard a bunch of lawyers on the plane the other day use the word vis-a-vis, and I was just thinking, you are lawyers. I know you are lawyers.
But what Jay was saying was before, I think, is that, and what you confirmed, that you have it's no one thing. It's the perfect storm of charisma, knowledge, enthusiasm, and actually working on the skill set of communicating to other people.
I would say it wouldn't have to be a perfect storm if you come over-prepared. Mm-hmm. So over-prepared would mean you walk up to onto the stage with a utility belt. Mm-hmm. And in that utility belt
there we go.
We have an inside joke.
Okay.
A skeptical utility belt.
Rebecca has a look of distaste on her face.
Right? Wear all their shit on their belt, Neil. Their cell phones. And they're so proud of it. And I said it's like a fanny pack, and they insist it's like a utility belt.
Oh, okay.
Thank you for summarizing.
Well, this is a philosophical utility belt.
I approve of that.
A creative utility belt. Where in that belt that you come to the stage, you can invoke a humorous reflection on a scientific theme. You can reference a pop culture icon or a pop culture event that you know most of the audience have heard about or read about that can then inform the otherwise non-linked information you're trying to share. You come up with the ability to move your body in a way that can assist you if necessary. And I've given talks before where they said, okay, here's your podium, and here's your fixed mic, and the podium is this large, and all they can see is my head sticking out above. And I'm thinking,
I can't work with those people.
I can't.
That'd have to be a pretty big podium.
And not only that, people would say, oh, could you send your talk in advance? No, I can't send my talk in advance, because the talk is the talk that I give. I'm screaming here. Sorry.
What you should do? You should
the talk is the talk I give when I give the talk. There is no advance. If there's an advance talk, why the hell invite me? I'll just mail you the talk and read the damn thing.
You should send them a cow brain. Go, I cut out a piece of my brain. There's my talk.
I'd have to wind down from that for a second.
right.
Just give me cool say something, there. Phil, just so I can wind down.
Neil Tyson, everybody.
Okay, thank you.
That'd be like a woman say, send me the date. No, I have to be there. It's a physical
send
thing.
Send me the date.
You probably get that a lot from women, to be honest.
Stop it.
Nice.
Neil, have you met my fiance?
Yes, we have.
Send me the ring. What I'm interested in, to contrast the amount of preparation, the huge amount...
Wait, I just finished my point. When you're overloaded, you don't know at any given instant what you might need because it depends on what the attention span factor is at that moment. So I might invoke one thing versus another in one situation and invert it in another situation. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So to say that everything is calculated, no, that's not really true because the more you calculate it, the less nimble you are when you have to be.
Yeah.
So you want a non-calculated capacity to express yourself.
It's called rolling with it. You're rolling with it.
You need enough wheels so that you roll.
You can roll with it. You have to draw. Sure.
Our metaphor is getting a little clunky.
No, so, Bob, go to school on this. You could learn something from this.
I'm not paying attention.
And once again, you know,
he's underprepared.
People ask us all the time about Steve. How does Steve write 4 blogs a week and, you know, do the show and post-produce the show and everything? And the answer always is it's a shitload of hard work. Yeah, it's hard work. It's the sweat. So there's no magic
behind
it.
Well, that's where I wanted to go next, was to contrast the amount of hard work that you do in these situations to, you know, Carl Sagan used to get a lot of crap from scientists who didn't respect him because of his ability to relate to the general public. And I think those scientists were missing the amount of work that goes into what you do and also the importance. So I'm wondering, or I should say the amount of work that Sagan did. And what I'm wondering is if you've seen a similar response from the hard science community.
A similar pushback?
Yeah.
No. And it's because when Carl did it, it had never really been done before, certainly not on that scale. And the most expected of an academic was maybe you'd write a textbook or perhaps a popular book based on the research that you did, just because it worked out. But the breadth and depth with which he engaged the public, the fact that he appeared on Johnny Carson, what a transgression that was.
Yeah.
It wasn't just a formal talk show. It was a comedic late night. So what he did was clear the brush. And the brush has not grown back. The brush is cleared. And my colleagues, who recognized in the wake of Sagan's efforts that funding improved, there was members of Congress knew of what we did simply because of the work of Carl Sagan. Yep. And they then became more charitable, more giving, more understanding of our plight as scientists in general and as astrofolk in particular. So I can say without hesitation that my field embraces this. Mm-hmm. And now you might wonder if I'm delusional. Right, it's easy to think that you're loved for what you do, but I have metrics for this, and it's the fact that I continue to receive invitations to serve on panels that advise agencies with regard to research monies, this sort of thing. People value what I have. If they didn't value it, I'd be persona non grata, and it would reveal itself overnight.
Yeah.
So yes, there's blood on the tracks that he left. I'm happy to say that the track that he left is wide, and many of us, I'm in there, but so is Phil, so is a half a dozen other people we all know and can list, and we're not bloodied because he led the way. Now, I cannot say the same for other scientific professions. I don't know that physics has the same capacity to embrace this activity that we do in astronomy. I don't know that geology does. I don't know that engineering does.
I've actually heard biologists, for instance, criticize some of the more prominent evolutionary biologists.
Meanwhile, just look at the numbers. Among all these scientific professions, the astrophysics community is the smallest, by far. Compare the several thousand astrophysicists in the world with the number of chemists. It's like a factor of 100 or something. Factor of 100. Yet some of the most visible scientists of the past half century have been astronomers.
So why is that? Why, where's all this charisma coming from?
Well, astronomy's cool. Those other ones are boring.
Yeah, we weren't asking. Sorry.
No, I have the answer. It's cosmic charisma.
It's a baby after
it's,
that.
It's cosmic charisma, baby.
I get a lot of pushback in the field of medicine, I have to tell you that. Academic medicine is very... It's difficult.
They should be glad that you're not a crackpot, given how many crackpot medical
people. Well, I think that may be part of the problem.
We have an advantage. We have very few crackpots. We get one a decade.
Yeah, maybe that is the issue.
That could be the issue. Yeah. Is that you're popularizing medicine? Are you a crackpot? Yeah. That's
because most you got to look at them a little strange when they do their thing.
Yeah, I know. I hear you.
Also, I mean, I always thought, though, that there is also an issue with the scientists who are doing their everyday, you know, work. Are worried about the people who are popularizing science misrepresenting it, oversimplifying it.
Oh, thanks for bringing that up.
You're welcome.
What I do that Sagan did not do, again, Sagan did it first, so you can't criticize anybody for doing it first because you got to make it up as you go along. I don't have to make it up as I go along because I can see what happened before me. What I do not do is if the evening – I live in New York City. It's – the major news gathering headquarters of the nation are 10 blocks away from my office. I'm the easiest date they could possibly construct for a soundbite for their news story. So if it's network and there's a major astro discovery and they want a soundbite and they call my office, I say, have you interviewed the person who did the work?
Right.
They're networked. They got people in every city. Get the interview. If you have not, I've got nothing to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
And they go, get the interview. Then it comes to me, and I am happy to tie a bow on the story, give it a cosmic perspective, make it real.
Yeah.
And in that context, the person who worked their butt off to do the research, typically it's a research result that they've been working on for 5 years, and they're pale because they haven't been out in the light for that long trying to get the story out. And now they finally get a little bit of attention.
Yeah.
It's their day in the sun.
Yeah.
But then they find out that when I'm attached to the story, it ratchets it up a few notches because then it gets the exposure, sure. And then people will appreciate it at the level they know they like, but they're in the story as well. And I do that consistently and persistently on purpose.
Neil deGrasse Tyson, thank you so much for coming back
on
the show.
Happy to be back with you guys.
Thank you, Neil.
You're welcome anytime.
I've never been interviewed by 7-8 people before.
It works, though, right? Oddly enough.
Yeah. It's a roundtable discussion, literally.
Right. Thank you, Neil.
Thank you.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 real and 1 fictitious. And I challenge my panel of expert skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. Is everyone ready for this week?
Let's do it.
So starting by. Ready.
I swept you guys last week.
Yeah.
Just saying. All right, here we go. Item number 1. An epidemiological study confirms that smoke-free workplace laws significantly decrease the incidence of heart attacks and sudden death by about 50%. Item number 2, researchers have demonstrated a simple method to improve the capacity and charging rate of lithium-ion batteries by a factor of 10. And item number 3, a new study shows that deforestation in high latitudes above 45 degrees contributes significantly to global warming. Jay, go first.
The one about the smoke-free environment, workplace environment, you know, it says that it cut the incident of heart attack and sudden death by about 50%. That's a lot. And there's not a lot of information in this one line here. I have a lot of questions. So I'm a little vague on that, and I think that number seems very high. Yeah, and the one about increasing the ion batteries by a factor of 10 by just changing the method that they charge it? That's an order of magnitude is profound for a battery. And man, this is one of those that I really want to be true. I don't know. That's interesting. I mean, there's so many factors that go into this. I don't think so. That one's definitely not seeming right to me. The last one about the deforestation in high altitudes, I'm sorry, in high latitudes can increase to global warming. Wow, that's interesting. And it does in a way make sense. I mean, it shows that the environment interacts, obviously, the flora interact with the atmosphere, and that could have an impact on the amount of what types of gases are in the atmosphere. That makes sense. So I think I'm going to go with the battery one as a fake.
Okay, Evan?
The one about the smoke-free workplace laws. I don't know about this one because for a smoke-free workplace, I mean, people are still smoking, okay? So maybe they're not smoking at work. I mean, they're still going out. Right? I mean, if they can't smoke at work, the people who do smoke and work there are going to find a way to get their smoke, even if they can't do it on premises. They'll go to their car. They'll take, you know, a ride somewhere. They'll go to the building next door or something. So I just don't know about that. With the one regarding lithium-ion batteries by a factor of 10, and we've spoken so many times on the show about how advancement in battery technology is a slow crawl to our lofty goals and aspirations of what we all want our batteries to be able to do, this would certainly go against that. But I'm not convinced that just because of that that's the reason why this one would be false. A simple method. I wonder what that simple method is. I'm going to be really interested to hear about this one. The one about deforestation in high latitudes. I'm trying to think if it has something to do with above 45 degrees, well, snow cover would otherwise occupy the space that the trees would otherwise occupy. And is there something having to do with the amount of surface area that's covered with snow and somehow gets direct sunlight that might have something to do with the increasing global warming? Maybe, but I can't put my finger on that really. So I'm kind of going with my heart here a little bit more than my mind, because I really want this battery one to be right more than anything. So I think the smoke-free workplace laws one is the fiction on this time around.
Okay, Rebecca?
Okay, that's funny because I think Evan just talked me into – I wasn't very sure because they all sound very plausible. The workplace deaths thing sounds drastic, especially considering that the laws haven't really been in place for very long. So that's a little tricky, but if it's a small study, I can see how maybe it got such a large number. I'm not sure. I can always believe anything you say about battery efficiency. I will probably say, okay, yeah, sure, that.
Million-fold increase.
Yeah, a gazillion. Yeah, an order of magnitude, yeah. Or 10, I don't know. Yeah, there's always something right. We're talking about in terms of battery efficiency. So the deforestation has been well known to contribute to global warming due to the fact that trees trap carbon dioxide. So that was very believable, although I was leaning towards that just because global warming is such a big and complex issue that there are a million different things that could affect it. And so I could see how this one could easily get tricky. And then Evan mentioned snow cover. Well, if the trees are cut down and snow is left, then there'd be a difference in the way that light is reflected. That would change how the Earth is warming or cooling. And in that case, I think that it would do the opposite. Deforestation, if it left bright white ground, would cause global cooling. So I think that one is the fiction.
All right, so we're all over the place, Bob. You're going to have to break the three-way tie.
Oh, wow. The lithium-ion batteries, factor of 10, yeah, I could see some simple, silly thing that maybe could just be added to the mix that could somehow have such a dramatic change. I mean, it says researchers have demonstrated. Big deal. You know, show me the battery that I could put into a flashlight or whatever. Demonstrations don't mean that much. I mean, they're great, and they're of course they're an important first step, but that's not surprising me that much. The first one, though, the smoking in the workplace, that one seems kind of sneaky to me because, first of all, decrease the incidence of heart attacks and sudden death by 50%. In who? The smokers or the people in the environment? Yeah.
That's why I said it's vague, you know?
To me, that's key. I don't think secondhand smoke, if it was the people that are just in the environment and not necessarily smoking, then 50% I think is way too high. And I think it's still too high for even the smokers. Cause I mean, you reach a set point. You smoke however many cigarettes a day. And you're pretty much going to get it, even if even if the amount you could smoke during the day is reduced a bit. You know, you'll go out to lunch and you'll have three, or when you go home you'll smoke a little bit more. That just seems way too high. It seems too vague on purpose, because I think that's a huge distinction, whether it's the smokers themselves or the secondhand inhalers. So for that reason, I'm going to say that one is fiction.
Okay. So Evan and Bob think the smoking one is the fiction. Jay, you think the battery one is the fiction. Rebecca, you think that the global warming one is the fiction. So I guess we'll take these in order. An epidemiological study confirms that smoke-free workplace laws significantly decrease the incidence of heart attacks and sudden death by about 50%. And that one is science.
Crap.
Sorry, Bob and Evan.
Smoke-free workplace. See, I didn't equate secondhand smoke. Is that going to be part of this answer, Steve?
So this is a population. It's a population-based study done at the Mayo Clinic. So it's everybody. It's not distinguishing among smokers versus secondhand people.
And don't forget that workplaces can also include bars.
Yeah, that's right.
That's true.
It does include bars, in fact.
You know, she's right, Evan.
So
I'm glad you're here to tell me these things.
They followed that. They looked at the 18-month period before Olmsted County passed their first smoke-free law for restaurants in 2002. And then the regional incidence of heart attack was 213.2 cases per 100,000. And then the 18 months following a comprehensive smoke-free ordinance in 2007, where restaurants and workplaces became smoke-free, and that rate dropped to 102.9 per 100,000. So a little bit more than 50%. Additionally, then during the same period, the incidence of sudden cardiac death fell from 152.5 to 76.6 per 100,000 residents. Also about a 50% drop. So these are relative risks, I'll point out, not absolute risk. But still, you could see, you know, sort of like 70-something fewer deaths, 100 fewer heart attacks over an 18-month period. That's, you know, it's pretty significant. And this does confirm other studies which are showing the same thing. The signal seems to be showing through in communities that pass these kinds of laws. The risk incidence of heart attacks has been decreasing. It's probably a combination of, and this study does not separate out these variables, but it's a combination of smokers smoking less, because it's a chunk of time during the day that they're not smoking, secondhand smoke exposure of other people, and some people just quit because it's too inconvenient to smoke, you know?
Quit smoking or quit the job?
They quit smoking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bad economy. It's easier to quit smoking than to quit a job.
Yeah.
Cigarettes are expensive, too.
So this is good news. I think this is going to have a significant effect on these laws being popular and spreading around, which I'm for because I hate being forced to be exposed to secondhand smoke.
I agree.
So for purely selfish reasons, I'm all in favor of it. But also as a physician, because people shouldn't smoke.
Yeah, I don't think you should really classify "I don't want to die of lung cancer" as selfish.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, or just like "I want to breathe."
And
even
if it doesn't cause lung cancer, I find it incredibly annoying. I'm happy.
That's why I add the "I want to breathe."
That's true. I do. Right. I feel like, you know, I should be able to go through my life without getting exposed to something as obnoxious as cigarette smoke. And I'm very happy the way things are now. I basically never get exposed to it because my work environment is smoke-free. My home is smoke-free. I, you know, finally got my parents to quit. So there's really no place that I go where I'm forced to be exposed to cigarette smoke. And that's great.
There's only one place I go that I'm ever exposed to cigarette smoke. And that place is the Amazing Meeting in Las Vegas.
Yeah, that's true.
Oh, yeah, in the hotel.
That's true. It's the casinos.
You're allowed to smoke in the casino. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I usually don't spend a lot of time.
And even
casino.
There, where they, like, you know, pump in oxygen and stuff, it's still really hard to sit at the bar. Like, my throat gets sore immediately.
Yeah. Let's go on to item number two. Researchers have demonstrated a simple method to improve the capacity and charging rate of lithium-ion batteries by a factor of 10. Jay, you think this one is fiction, just too good to be true. Everyone else thinks this one is science. And this one is science.
Whoa! Woo! Bittersweet.
Yeah. I'm happy about that.
And, of course, you know, Bob's caveats all stand. We don't know how this will translate to an actual product. But it does seem like, and again, I see these things all the time. It's like a new advance in solar panels and stuff. It's like almost every week you see news items where they're making some incremental advance. And we've also talked at length about the hidden downsides. You know, they talk about the one feature that's really great and not about these downsides. They're assuming they're going to be able to figure out that actually kill the technology. But this one, you know, sounds really good. What researchers found, this is a scientist at Northwestern University, is they used a milling method to essentially make a bunch of tiny little holes in the layers in the graphene coating.
Increase the surface area?
Yeah, they increase the surface area and allow the ions, I guess, to move a little bit more freely. So one advantage, it seems to be a simple manufacturing method, nothing too complicated. It's being applied to standard lithium-ion batteries, so it's not like you have to use some entirely new substances or infrastructure. And the effects were to increase both the capacity and the charging rate. So it charges 10 times faster and it holds 10 times the charge. Holy it still shit. Has... It
gets 10 times hotter.
Right? Well, there may be something like that that will crop up, but...
Yeah, it's 100,000 times more expensive.
No, okay, it's the same material. It just, you do this method, which they say is simple, a simple ball milling method. So it seems like it's not going to be a limiting factor. The one thing that's worse about it, though, is the charge-discharge cycles. So the slope by which the capacity decreases with each cycle of charge and discharge is greater than with the current batteries. But even after 150 charges, they say it has 83% of capacity retention at over 150 charge-discharge cycles. And then even then, it still has greater capacity and recharge rate than current batteries. So even if it drops off very quickly, it still will have greater capacity than current batteries. Also, you have to consider that because it's holding 10 times the charge, like let's say this kind of battery when your cell phone, the charge-discharge cycles are 10 times as long, right? So 150 cycles would be 10 times as long as 150 cycles on current batteries, right? Because they're lasting 10 times as long. You'd have to charge your phone once a week instead of every day or something like that.
Wow.
That'd be nice.
We'll have to see. Maybe somebody 5 years from now could send a message back in time and let us know how this worked out.
Superman.
Or Magneto, since he's a time traveler. As we already established, established that Magneto travels back in time to the moon. Yeah.
Fact.
Okay. Let's go on to number three. A new study shows that deforestation in high latitudes above 45 degrees contributes significantly to global warming. And this one is the fiction.
Hooray for me.
And Evan, you hit it, man. You hit it, but you just didn't take it to its full conclusion. It's because the taking down the trees exposes more snow-covered surfaces. The snow reflects the sunlight and therefore absorbs less of the heat, so it actually causes cooling. In addition, there's a second method.
I dedicate this win to Evan.
I'll take the assist on this win.
An assist, but didn't assist yourself.
Win Rebecca. Gold Rebecca.
But Rebecca, there's a second mechanism. It's not just that the snow is reflecting back the sunlight. It's also...
I don't care.
Out of interest, I didn't think of this too either until I read the article. Right. They say that at nighttime when the sun isn't shining, the deforested areas actually cool more quickly, that the more of the warm air escapes to higher levels, whereas the trees sort of keep the hot air trapped. And
blanket.
Yeah, it's like a blanket too. Mm. So
canopy.
So, good work, Rebecca.
Thank you. Thank you.
Not bad. Not bad.
Whatever.
honorable mention.
Turned out
for
to
me,
be so interesting.
I'm cool.
Mm-hmm. You got to take what you can get, Evan.
And I learned an important lesson about listening to my fellow podcasters.
Right. About not going first in science or fiction.
Shut up, Steve.
Quiet you.
Look, I took the bullet this week for everyone, okay?
Well, Jay, do you have a quote for us?
Ivan Kisilov. Ivan sends me a quote. From a man named Ivan Pavlov, 1849-1936, was a famous Russian physiologist. Although he made significant contributions to physiology, he was not, in fact, a psychologist himself and actually had strong distaste for the field. This is a really cool quote. Perfect as the wing of a bird may be, it will never enable the bird to fly if unsupported by the air. Facts are the air of science. Without them, a man of science can never rise. Ivan Pavlov!
Jay, tell us about Nexus 2012.
Yeah, Nexus 2012 is happening April 21 to 22 in New York City. We've been working on securing the lineup for it. Everything is looking great. We're having a really good time working on the event this year. We're getting a lot better at putting these things together. And I just think everyone should come if you haven't come. And if you did come last year or the year before that, you should come again.
All right. Thanks, Jay. Well, thanks for joining me this week, everyone.
Surely. Thank you, Steve.
Hey, it was fun.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcasts, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.